Righty-ho, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second part of the our Sangha day, or well, not Sangha day, what we've got, Sangha evening, Tuesday night regulars class. And I'm continuing this series on tales or stories from the Buddha's day, or from the Buddhist texts, from the Pali Canon. Now I'm going to give a story that many of you will have already heard in various different versions. It's probably one of the most well-known stories in the Pali Canon. It's the story of Angulimala, the finger necklace. That's it, we've got Yasha Bodhi doing the visuals over there. Yes, the famous or notorious bandit or thief or mass murderer, depending on which particular epithet you want to use. Now, not only is it the exciting story that gets people nowadays, is it obviously was a story that was fascinating to people, you know, not just at the Buddha's time, but afterwards, during the period after the Buddha's death, when they were putting together the various different elements of the Buddhist text, the Buddhist canon, as it were. Because Angulimala appears in lots of different places. He appears in a sutta, you know, his own sutta, and the Angulimala Sutta, a sort of piece of canonical work that actually describes the Buddha's meeting with him. He also appears in the Jataka tales. There's a Jataka on him, which a Jataka is one of the sort of stories of someone's previous life, usually about the Buddha, but in this case there's one about Angulimala. He appears in the commentaries. There's lots of commentaries on this sutta. He appears in there. He appears in the Theragata. The Theragata, which is a text about different enlightened beings. And Tarakarunya mentioned to me just before the class started, oh, I know a little story about Angulimala, and she told me this other little version, another variation on, you know, on the story. So, obviously people are very fascinated by the story. And I think the reason why, or one of the main reasons why, is it because the story is a puzzle. And the puzzle is, how is it that someone who is so bad, as it were, so cruel, so nasty, you know, who kills so many people, how is it that that person ends up being a Buddha? How can that be? And a lot of the other material, the commentaries and the Jatakas and all the rest of it, are attempts to explain that problem and explain this conundrum. You know, how is it possible, you know, that this is the case? Because in the actual sutra itself, it's very brief. You know, you don't actually get anything in the backstory of Angulimala. You just bang there, straight into the action, really, you know. So, I'm going to give a version of the story which is made up from all the different parts. And I'm going to go through it sort of, I suppose you could call it chronologically. Bring out, you know, I think some of those sort of lessons from the story, as there were some things we can learn and understand. Okay, here we go. The story begins long ago, very far away in ancient India. And it begins with a king, King Pasenadi of the kingdom of Kosala. And King Pasenadi will become, I'm not sure at this time whether he was a disciple of the Buddha, but he was close to it. You know, it's close to the time when the Buddha became enlightened, probably around about this sort of period, I think. Anyway, one evening, or one night, King Pasenadi had a very restless night. Bad dreams kept happening, and tossed and turned, and he woke up suddenly in the middle of the night. And in his room, he had these weapons on the wall, his favorite weapons. And they were shining with a ghostly light, with a strange radiance. And they seemed to be rattling and moving and making peculiar noises. And they were sort of like shouts and screams and cries of pain. And he was like, oh my God, what's happening? And then it went. It just disappeared like a bad dream. Anyway, so the king got up. He demanded, you know, to see his ministers and, you know, demanded an explanation of what was going on. And his various people came in and said, they were telling the story of what happened in the armory and all the weapons in the armory sort of lit up and what happened in other places and other people had heard these strange sounds and these noises. And everyone, the whole city, the city of Sarasvati, was disturbed and agitated. So they said, right, can someone go and find my chaplain, my Brahmin chaplain? We need him here to explain this. One of the servants then turned to the king and says, I don't think he can come because his wife is just given birth at this very moment. So the king says, well, I will wait. You didn't have to wait long for this Brahmin. I'm trying to read out his name. It's quite an odd sort of name. Where are we now? Oh, yeah. Bhagava Gaga. I was not going to bring that one up, actually. I was tempted to bring that joke up, but I left that to Tara Karunya. Okay. So his wife was a Lady Gaga. Yeah, right. Anyway, Bhagava Gaga. And his wife, Mantani. Actually, that's kind of, that sounds Italian, doesn't she? Anyway, they'd given birth, and she'd given birth to a son at the time of all these events. So anyway, the king was about to congratulate him, but Bhagava was not in a happy looking state. He looked worried and tense. And so the king said, was there a problem? He said, well, yes, there was all these things going on, you know, the birth of my son. And so I did a divination. And what came up was, you know, my son is going to be a terrible bandit. And it's like, oh, dear. And so the king said, what, do you mean like a sort of leader of bandits? No. He's just going to be a solitary bandit. You know, a solitary killer of others. You know, that's all, just by himself. So both these men were rather shocked by it. But they both agreed to give the young boy a chance. So they named him, he was named Ahimsaka, which means the harmless one, I think rather hopefully, extremely hopefully. And initially, for quite a few years of his early life, the boy lived up to his name. He was extremely dutiful, extremely studious, quiet sort of boy. And he looked up to his parents, and he was not in the slightest bit violent. It was true that he was a big lad, a very strong lad, incredibly strong actually, and could run really fast. He had all these physical attributes. But he was a kindly soul. There didn't seem to be anything wrong with him. So the sort of worry that they had about his birth begin to fade, and maybe it's just all a bit of a bad dream, and it's just, you know, I did something wrong with the divination. Maybe it's nothing to do with it at all. Okay, so what they did was, his parents, they decided to send him to, well, they call it university in here, which is not really the case. It's more to go to a master, you know, to get trained up as a Brahmin priest or something like that. So he goes to a place called Taxila, which actually is a famous city in ancient India. It was famous for its learning. And so young Ahimsaka goes to that city and he finds himself a master, and a very well-known master, probably was introduced by a letter from the king, you know, this is a great boy, you know, please take him on. So he goes and he moves into the master's house, which was fairly standard, and he joined with the other disciples of this master, a small little group, and they were all to study under this man. So that should have gone very well for him. And in some ways it did. He was a very good student, very dutiful, very intense, sort of, you know, really trying incredibly hard to learn what was asked of him. Very dutiful young man. But the other students didn't like him. They started to feel uncomfortable about him, and they started to feel that somehow he was wrong, he shouldn't be there, or there's something not right about him. And they started to gang up against him, basically. They couldn't confront him directly. I mean, they knew from the sort of bit of play wrestling that this guy you just wouldn't want to mess with. You know, he was very strong and could throw anyone, even adults, experienced wrestlers, poof, on their back. So they knew they couldn't face him in that way. So they tried something else. They started to spread rumours about him. Slanders that this is a nasty piece. This guy's a nasty piece of work. Don't trust him. You know, he's going to do something nasty. They were dripping these little drops of poison into various people's ears, particularly the master. You know, oh, I think he's after your job, you know. And the master, he was not an unkindly man, just missed it all. You know, you're just jealous, you know. He's a great boy, just be friends with him, please. But the drips kept going. And then one guy went and says, I've seen Ahimsaka looking at your wife. He had a young wife, it seems. And then, worse still, another woman said, he'd seen your young wife looking at Ahimsaka. So this began to eat into the master. And began to build and build and build. So he's watching Ahimsaka and his wife like a hawk. At one point, he just catches them. He sees them, for some reason or another, probably very innocent, just accidentally touched her hand with his little finger. And it's like boiling with rage. But he hid it all. Anyway, very shortly after that, it comes to the end of the, the student year, isn't it? The academic year, whatever it was in those days. They're all graduating, and part of the sort of tradition of this sort of graduation was that you would give a gift to the master. The master would ask you for a gift, and then you would produce it for them. And, you know, once you'd given the gift, the master would give his blessing, and that blessing was the final seal on the whole thing. That once that blessing was given, the education was complete, and you were able then to teach yourself, or able then to impart knowledge. Without that blessing, you could not do anything with that knowledge. You had to have that blessing. So all the students went up one by one to the master, and they all were asked to give certain gifts, and they were all very happy to do it, and, you know, along it went very well, until Ahimsaka, and he bowed down to his master, and asked his master what he could do for him. And his master says, I want a necklace. Oh. So that's not too difficult. And then the image of the finger came into the master's mind and said, but I want a necklace of fingers. 1,000 little fingers from 1,000 hands. I want these. And Ahimsaka was like devastated. He's like completely stunned. It's like somebody had hit him over the head with a large rock. He's like, you know, because he'd never thought there was anything amiss between him and the master. He just couldn't understand it. He was totally confused. I mean, what could the master be thinking of? Was this some sort of joke or a test? He just didn't know, did not have a clue. And the master came said, unless you bring me this necklace, I will not give you my blessing. You will not have my blessing. So Ahimsaka left and sort of wandered about in a confused daze, wondering what he could do. And obviously the master probably thought, you know, Ahimsaka trying to get these fingers will get killed, someone will kill him, for certain. Anyway, after a little while, Ahimsaka sort of settled down, and he wondered what to do, and he came to a conclusion. The only thing he could do was to follow his master's instructions. That was the only thing he could do, and he would follow them diligently, to the letter. He made his mind up, and though he was a young man, he had this, it seems, a great capacity to make his mind up. So he did. He would get those 1,000 fingers. And so he armed himself with sword and shield, with spear and bow and arrows. And he headed up to a forest called the Forest of Jalini, a great forest, dark forest, deep forest. And he went up to the top of the highest crag in that forest, and he looked out across the whole forest, the whole landscape. And he could see not just the forest, but beyond it, the small villages surrounding. So from that position, he was able to dominate the whole place. No one could get into the forest without him knowing. And no one came out alive. Because he'd have them, and the little finger would go. They would go with it. So the villagers stopped going to the forest. I mean, what can they do? Even armed parties of the villagers would just disappear. They would just go. Nobody knew where they went. They'd just go. And everyone was getting more and more afraid. So people stopped going into the forest. But that was not the end of it. Because Ahimsaka, or as he began to get known of locally as Angulimala, the finger necklace, from somewhere, who knows where, they heard the story. From somewhere, probably he just wore it. But anyway, there it was, the necklace of fingers, the finger necklace. So, Angulimala, as he was then known, they stopped going into the forest, they sort of kept out of it, kept to the villages, but Angulimala did not leave them alone. For at night he would creep down into the villages and into their houses, and the neck and the finger gone, and he would slink off with his booty of fingers. So complete and absolute terror in the whole area, and everyone fled, and they were fleeing towards Sarasvati and where the king lived, and his capital. And so news of all this reached King Pasenadi, and not knowing who this guy was, all he knew was the name Angulimala, he got together a council of war and says, right, we're going to track this guy down, we're going to get him, call out the army, drums beating, the conch shells blowing, the army assembles. Now is the time for a short break, and what's the word now? A word from our sponsor. I'm just going to look back a little bit over what we just covered and bring out a couple of points. There's something very quite interesting about the story, I think, with the quality, the character of Angulimala. Now, truth be told, I've actually heightened it slightly in the telling. You know, I have to admit that I've just added a little few details and heightened it. But the actual source of what I'm going to say is in the texts. And there's one word that comes out a few times, which is really, really interesting. It's the word alone. Do you know, you remember back when he got born and the king asked the guy's dad, is he going to be a leader of bandits, or is he going to do it by himself? He's going to do it alone. He's going to be alone. And then later on, you know, with the master, his relationship with the other students, he was isolated from them. He was not a party, not a part of the student body, as it were. He was essentially isolated. He was alone. And when he went into the forest, he went into the forest alone, by himself. And he did all those terrible deeds alone, by himself. No one else was there, just him. And he had to have had incredible courage, incredible fearlessness, and incredible determination and skill in order to achieve this, that sojourn in the forest. You know, there's a quote actually from, it's not on here. Anyway, it's from Samuel Johnson, which I find quite interesting about the sort of qualities that you need to do with Angulimala and Angulimala did. And this is where Samuel Johnson talks about courage when he says, courage is so necessary for virtue that we applaud it even when it is joined to vice. Courage is so necessary to virtue that we applaud it even when it's joined to vice. So this quality of courage, even though it leads to this horrible consequences, is actually still a great quality that this man has. I'm just going to take it one little step further then before we carry on. Is there anyone else for which the term alone in the forest could refer to? Does it ring any bells? The Buddha. That's it, the Buddha. In a strange sort of way, Angulimala is like a shadow Buddha. You know, from a sort of symbolic, even mythical point of view, you could say that he's got a lot of the qualities that the Buddha had. He's alone and resolute in the forest. You know, he tackles his enemies like the Buddha tackled Mara. You know, he's there with this immense, you know, will and determination to fulfill his duty. But unlike the Buddha, he has no compassion. There's a qualitative difference. There is that point, you know, that quality of compassion is completely absent in him. So he's not the Buddha, but in a strange sort of way, he has an affinity to him, I think. There is this peculiar mirror-like quality. And that actually comes out a bit later when they actually have their meeting. This odd mirror-like aspect of their relationship, of their characters, I should say. Okay, so we're going to get back to the story. So a little recap, you know, up it comes on the screen, you know, back and what was it now? Of course, in like the what was it one?
To be continued.
No, it's like the New Hope, isn't it? The third of the Star Wars, you know, the thing comes up. Here we go. So it's like, we have Angulimala in the forest, right? He's chased out all the local villagers. They've all gone fleeing. They've all gone to see the king. And the king is getting together his army to wreak vengeance on Angulimala. Meanwhile, back, back at the ranch, or back at his parents' house, his mother sort of hears the news of this guy in the forest. You know, like everyone else, she's rather put out by and upset by it. But somehow, she sort of gets a sense that this is her young boy, her young son. I mean, she'd heard little stories of being in the master and him going off and disappearing. And somehow she put it all together and said, this must be it, this must be my son. And without telling her husband, because he would disapprove, she knew that well enough, she slunk out and went off into the forest, went off towards the forest. Now, she didn't do it alone, at least not knowingly, because the Buddha also picked up something as well. Now, the stories say, and in these texts say that it, that he knew that Angulimala's mother was heading out there, and if Angulimala killed his own mother, that would be the most devastating thing could possibly happen. I mean, he's only killed 999 people anyway. I mean, you know, you could say, well, what did it? Just one more. But, you know, he felt that, you know, that this was, you know, pretty bad. You know, it's as bad as it could get. So he also made his way towards the forest. And let's see if I can find that quote. Oh, yes. Cowherds, shepherds and ploughmen passing by saw him taking the road to where Angulimala was and said, do not take that road, monk. On that road is the bandit Angulimala, who's murderous, bloody-handed, giving to harming and violence. He is merciless to all living beings. Villages and towns and districts are being laid waste by him. He's constantly murdering people. He wears their fingers as a garland. Men coming along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, or even 40, but they still have fallen into Angulimala's hands. And what did the Buddha do when he was told all of this? He ignored them and carried on. He didn't even answer them, really. He stayed silent. So anyway, up on his peak, up on his cliff top, Angulimala is surveying his domain of death and destruction, empty and abandoned. Just, he is now more alone than ever. There's not a single living soul anywhere in sight, except for one, an old woman walking away slowly along towards him. Now, whether he knew, it says in the text that he recognized his mother and was, oh, here we are, 1,000, oh, she'll do. I'm not sure what I believe in any of this, but I believe that even less than a lot of the things in this story. Anyway, before he gets down from his high point, he sees someone else, even closer than his mother. A shramana, a wanderer, a guy with a patchwork, stained robe, you know, shaven head, or at least cut short, rather, you know, not sort of obviously well off or anything, but well, it's a finger, you know, salabi. So, I'll get him first. Right, he's closer. So he took his weapons, his sword, his shield, his spear, and his bow, and he set off at a brisk trot down the side of the mountain, down the side towards the road that ran through the forest, path that ran through the forest. You just about see this guy, you know, in the yellow robe, look way ahead. Oh yeah, no problems, you know, I'm really fit, he's probably not, you know, just sitting around meditating, he's probably going to be really slow and it can be really easy, piece of cake. Jogging along. How far is this guy ahead of me? Oh, a bit further than I thought. Okay. He keeps going. Don't seem to be getting any closer. That's weird. So he starts, you know, not just having a little jog, but actually running. And the guy is, and he just seems to, just a little bit, just round the corner. He gets the corner, the guy's still just round the corner. He just keeps him going. And eventually he just bolts for it, just really goes for it. Full speed. And the man's just still ahead of him. He's still ahead. How could that be? That's impossible. He's saying to them, I've run down elephants. I've run down oxen. I've run down deer. I've run down horses. Each one of them I catch and I bring down. But this man, he's still ahead of me. It's like, he gets to a point, he gets to a tree and he puts his hand on this tree. And like, completely exhausted, he's total exasperation and frustration, he shouts out to this geezer in front of him. He says, stop! Guy still keeps going. He suddenly turns around, and as he's walking, he says, oh, I have stopped. And Gilliamal is like, now really confused. Yeah, I've stopped, but you haven't. And it's like, he's looking at, he's completely flummoxed. He knows that the guy in some way is telling the truth. He sort of intuits, he picks up that the guy is telling the truth, but it completely contradicts his experience, totally contradicts it. And he's just absolutely confused for the second time in his life. You know, he had that first mass, and for the second time he's like completely confused, you know, as what is happening. So, what happened next? So this is Angulimala asking questions. This is directly from the Sutta, Angulimala Sutta. While you are walking, monk, you tell me you have stopped. But how, when I have stopped, you tell me that I'm not stopped. I ask you now, O monk, what's the meaning of this? How is it that you have stopped and I have not? The Blessed One, who I presume is still walking along, looking round behind him, says, Angulimala, I have stopped forever forswearing violence to every living being. But you have no restraint towards things that breathe. So that is why I have stopped and you have not. When Angulimala heard these words, there was a sudden great change in him. Now, the wonder sometimes with these sort of texts is that sometimes you read and think, oh, that's all pretty obvious, isn't it? You know, it's a sort of riddle, isn't it? And it's not a particularly difficult one, to be honest. You know, I've heard more difficult riddles than this. And I suppose, you know, with a little bit of working out and a bit of prompting, Angulimala could have worked it out himself. But it's nothing really to do with that, of course. It's just, it's the context, it's the whole situation of him finding himself with this man who just confronts him. It's this mirror quality again. You know, I think like this sort of opposites. He just puts his opposite point of view to him, and he just catches him just at the right moment. And the response from Angulimala is, "Oh, at long last, a sage revered by me, that monk now appears in the great forest. Indeed, I will sure renounce all evil, hearing your stanzas showing the Dharma." So saying, he threw down his sword, his weapons, and flung them in a great pit. And the bandit worshipped the Sublime One's feet. And there and then, he asked for the going forth. The enlightened man, the sage of great compassion, the teacher of the world and of gods and men, addressed him with these words, "Come, bhikkhu." And that was how he became a bhikkhu. That was how Angulimala became a bhikkhu. But I'm going to stop again for a moment, second break, and just bring out another sort of thing about this story, which I find very important. Now, a lot of us, I think, when we come across Buddhism, when we come to Buddhism, we read a Buddhist text, or we come to a Buddhist centre, and Ratnaprabha, or Jinananda, or Tarakarunya, you know, says, you know, a piece of Dharma knowledge, gives him, you know, everything is impermanent, or some similar thing. But goes, oh yeah, that's right, things are impermanent, you know, things are unsatisfactory. Wow, that's saying something which I've been wanting to say and not quite got the words, and there it is. It confirms, you know, what I've always believed the whole time. You know, this is how things are, and it confirms it, right? So you feel this nice, comfortable feeling of, ooh, that's right, I'm right. You know, this is good. And so, you know, I remember once from my first study group with Subhuti, and that was the time he actually led study groups, for those of you who know him. And, you know, he talked about, you know, things interrelating, and I thought, oh, I know all about that. Oh, I remember that, because I did a course in ecology, and it's about like ecology, it's all linked up there. And I thought, God, this is so wonderful. Isn't Buddhism so wonderful? He just confirms which I already know. Marvellous. Now, the trouble is that doesn't really help us. Confirming something that we already know, that we've already incorporated into quite often our ego identity, into our sense of pride, our sense of self-worth, doesn't really help in the long run. You know, it can make us feel a bit more comfortable, make us sort of fit in easier. But really, the points that actually help us is when someone turns around and says no to us. No, you're not right. That is not how it is. Who actually confront us, actually like a mirror, show us something of the truth, but round the other way, or in a different light, or from a different point of view we did not expect. And sometimes this produces a sort of crisis, where we've got a choice at this point. We could either go along with this, we could say, okay, I'm willing to give it a go, I'm willing to have a look at this, or you could say, ooh, I didn't sign up for this one, mate. Oh, no, 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 no. Ooh, this is too much for me. I'm going to do something a little easier, you know. We could do that. We have this choice. You know, when we are confronted with something that's different from something we already had, a completely different perspective. So this experience of Angulimala is actually mirrored in ourselves, and not hopefully at this sort of level. We're not hopefully any mass murderers here? Serial killers? Jinanda? No? Okay. So it's not, you know, at this sort of level, but it's still going on. The basic principle is still going on. I mean, Buddhism actually uses this sort of approach, you know, in Zen particularly, in the koans. It's something rather like this in this sort of attitude. Okay, so I'm just going to check the time. All right, got a little bit longer. So moving on now, on with the story. So you remember, back with King Pasenadi, getting his army together? Okay, good. Well, the Buddha now has his own army, I suppose one could call it, his army of righteousness, or whatever. Basically, a group of bhikkhus get together, and they're walking towards Kosala, the kingdom of Kosala, and they meet the king coming the other way, going towards the forest. And they stop, because King Pasenadi is a follower of the Buddha, and he gets down and he pays his respect, and he asks, you know, if the Buddha needed anything, if everything was right, and they exchange pleasantries. And then the Buddha asks him, well, where are you off to, where are you going? And he says, well, I'm going to finish off that vagabond, that pain in the arse, that so-and-so who's mucking up my kingdom. Angulimala, he has been terrorizing the land, and I have vowed to get rid of him, and I'm taking this army with me to do that very thing. Ah, says the Buddha. Well, what if, just say what if, you were to meet Angulimala now, but rather than being a bandit, he was one of my disciples, a monk, a bhikkhu, I should say, a bhikkhu. And the king said, oh yeah, right, oh well, if that was the case, you know, I suppose I would, you know, show him reverence, thinking, what's the Buddha up to now? Well, here he is. And there he was, Angulimala, shaven head, in robes, carrying a bowl. He probably wasn't hiding behind a Buddha. Well, the Buddha was quite a stalwart chap, wasn't he? They did say he was quite well built. But probably Angulimala was bigger, even bigger still. Big chap, big lad. Anyway, he came out and was, ooh, you know, everyone sort of stepped back a little bit. This is the famed, the infamous Angulimala. So the king was rather sort of caught out now, and so, did a sort of presumably perfunctory little bow, you know, okay, right, I've done my reverence. The king asked, well, what happened? So he got a bit of the story, as we've just said, about what happened and how it all come about. And so the army turned around, went back, and in a way it was all over. At least that part of it was. But Angulimala now was part of the Buddhist Sangha, and particularly was one of the ascetics, one of the bhikkhus. And to, you know, he started practicing meditation and a whole range of things. Now, there's lots of things I could say about this, but we're running out of time. So I'll just mention one particular incident that happened after this point. Interesting enough, happened after he became enlightened. Well, not a single incident, but a number of incidents. Now, you imagine this guy who's notorious, infamous as being a mass murderer. He comes in with his begging bowl into a village that he's previously terrorized. And he's being very peaceful, being made very mindful, being very non-violent. The villagers, on the other hand, think, now's our chance. So, in anger and resentment, in to give vengeance, they attack him. They beat him up, basically, and he comes staggering back to the rest of the Sangha, to the Buddha, sort of blooded and, you know, clothes torn, bruised and bleeding. And the Buddha says, bear it. Bear it, brother, bear it. And he goes back out there some other day. The same thing happens. I'll just read the little bit here. Yep, here we go. With blood running from his injured head, with his bowl broken and with his patchwork robe torn, the venerable Angulimala went to the Blessed One. The Blessed One saw him coming, and he told him, "Bear it, brother, bear it. You have experienced here and now the ripening of karma, whose ripening you might have experienced in hell over many a year, many a century, many a millennia." So the Buddha is basically saying, this is easy, in a sense. What's happening here now is the consequences of your actions. And if it wasn't happening now, it would happen in another way, in another place, as they used to say in the good old days about hell, calling it the other place. So, and there's a number of things I can say about this. I'm not going to go into this in very much detail. But I find it very interesting, this, the whole issue of karma, in the sense that on one hand, I think the Buddha's talking about, I may actually in some of this been using the term karma in quite a loose way, I don't know, maybe not a very strict sort of sense. I mean, you could say, well, karma just means action. So what you're experiencing now, ahimsaka, is that you've terrorized these people, of course they're going to want vengeance. You know, that's the consequences of terrorizing them. It might be that is meaning. But it may also be something more karmic, you know, that in some means or other, you know, what he did caused these people to do this thing. I don't really know. I mean, my own understanding of karma is more, if you like, you could term psychological. In other words, it's more about you have one mental state, you create one mental state. So a state of generosity, and that will support another mental state. It will help in the arising of another mental state of happiness. You produce a mental state of whining resentment, and that will produce a mental state of unhappiness. That's sort of my discussion come. He's just sort of describing something else. I don't know if it's true. It's for me, it's some sort of a mystery, as it were. I like, in a sense, a lot of the story, because the central mystery of how this man changed is still there. You know, it's still. I mean, it really points to me the essential mystery, as it were, about how any of us change. You know, it's like sometimes I just find myself, I'm sitting in meditation and I've got this really bad mental state going on, and then I said, okay, I don't want this mental state anymore, I'm going to change it. And it changes. And sometimes I think, oh, that's interesting. How did that happen? I think some of us, or some maybe, certainly me, just find that whole process of spiritual development quite odd in a certain way, in a very good way, but sort of odd and a bit mysterious, a bit strange, of how things develop, how things change. So I'm going to finish off there now. That's the story of Angulimala. Nothing really much happens after that. He's enlightened and, you know, probably has a good old time of it, and that's it really. So interesting, all the interesting part of his life is gone, you know, when he wasn't enlightened, that's all the interesting bit. That's the bit that people want to talk about. But he obviously led a peaceful and harmless life after that.